Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the podcast. The VOC podcast is about ideology, communist and Marxist ideology. And it's about education, educating Americans and people of the world to these destructive ideologies that have brought tyranny and misery to hundreds of millions. My goal is to facilitate the transition away from communism in China by peaceful means. I'm seeking to do this by revealing the true nature of Chinese communism and its false ideology. Second, I want to prevent American Marxism from ever coming to power in the United States. As I mentioned, this podcast is about ideology, not people. Everyone is free to believe in whatever they like. However, there are certain truths, and it is these truths that I explore in each podcast. Topics for the podcast alternate between the major ideologies of Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics, as the Chinese communists call their ideology, and American Marxism that is quietly infiltrating and subverting the free and open democratic system in the United States. For this episode, I'll be combining both topics in the discussion of Maoism and its relationship to woke ideology. I am indebted for this section of the podcast to the book The Strategy of Maoism in the West, Rage and the Radical Left, an excellent intellectual expose by David Martin Jones and M.L.R. Smith, two British professors of war studies at King's College in London. I interviewed the authors, and you can hear from them later in the podcast. The starting point for my discussion of Maoism and the radical left is the summer of 2020. That's when demonstrations led by the group Black Lives Matter erupted throughout the United States after the killing of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis. The riots that destroyed several downtown cities with little or no police opposition and much support from Democratic politicians triggered a high-intensity political campaign by American Marxists who systematically exploited the rage and unrest for nefarious ideological purposes. What are those purposes? First, it was to weaken and ultimately replace the American system of capitalism and free markets with a system of socialism. Not the constitutional or social democrat version of socialism, but the socialism that for Marxist-Leninists steeped in the dynamics of seizing and holding on to political power is merely the stepping stone of the inevitable march toward communism, the chimera of an ideal workers' paradise. Karl Marx captured this utopian idea in 1875 in seeking to produce a system guided by the humanitarian notion from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. Marx's idea was given shape by Vladimir Lenin in the 1917 revolution in Russia that first brought the communists to power. The revolution and its offshoots have produced 105 years marked by mass death and tyranny. Many believe communism ended with the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991. Today, Chinese communism is on the march and engaged in an ideological assault on the West that seeks to create a world dominated by Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics, the euphemism for Chinese communism. The goal of the BLM-inspired riots in 2020 were aimed at what former President Barack Obama, whose views were shaped by some of the Marxist New Left radicals of the 60s, called the fundamental transformation of America. The riots produced mass protests of mainly students who tore down statues of American founders, who the radicals asserted must be swept aside as irredeemably scarred by the stigma of past slavery, colonialism, and racism. In addition to statues, woke radicals rushed to rename buildings on university campuses, other public spaces, and eventually forced name changes of U.S. military bases. In my home state, the ski resort called Squaw Valley was pressured to change its name to Palisades, reacting to pressure from the woke radicals who influenced the Native American community. The Biden administration later decreed that Squaw could not be used for any name on federal land. No target of American history was spared from the anti-racism woke mobs. Even statues of President Abraham Lincoln, the president who freed the slaves and guided America through the horror of the Civil War, came under fire from Marxist revolutionaries. The liberal political establishment, mainly in the Democratic Party, but some Republicans as well, along with university administrators, business leaders, and especially senior leaders in the news media and entertainment industry, essentially surrendered to the radicals. Fear of mobs forming outside their homes and accusing them of racism, there was little regard for the impact the leftist juggernaut would have on civil society. The result has been a dangerous decline in basic law and order and the loss of confidence in the democratic system. Since the summer of 2020, radical Marxists have prevented and muffled much free speech and severely stifled honest and open debate and discussion throughout the nation. Say the wrong thing now and you'll be a victim of the cancel culture and become a non-person without access to social media in what in the communist world is known as an enemy of the people. Science, that is embraced by many today as a replacement for religion, also is being corrupted and subordinated to woke ideology. The BLM movement is only the latest iteration of radical Marxist ideology that failed in an earlier time to weaken the American system as part of the march toward communist revolution. BLM is a loose, decentralized collection of chapters and affiliates, but it self-identifies as Marxist. Among its stated goals is the elimination of the nuclear family, built on marriage between a man and a woman, that has been the bedrock of society for centuries. BLM is a revolutionary movement that falsely believes systemic and institutional racism is everywhere in America, in schools, universities, media, and business, and across the public and private sectors. That capitalist system, as I will always emphasize, has provided the most human freedom and development and more technological advances and prosperity for the entire world in all human history. American Marxists decry slavery and see it as its remnants everywhere. They selectively and hypocritically target free Western societies, for the practice has dated to ancient times, but has largely been eliminated globally. Marxists systematically avoid criticizing China, where slave labor is still used by the Chinese Communist Party in the Laogai system. Laogai means prison reform through labor and includes a vast camp of system rivaling the worst excesses of the Soviet Union's Gulag archipelago. Prison slave labor in China helped that state to become the economic powerhouse it is today, yet few voices on the American Marxist left have called for ending the practice. Contemporary anti-racists, radical environmentalists, and the gender and sexual identity movement are fueling and promoting resentment and righteous indignation that is the key element behind American Marxist drive for power. Jones and Martin, in their book, The Strategy of Maoism, state that iconoclasm, the practice of attacking or rejecting cherished beliefs and institutions, is rooted in the religious impulse. This furthers the fundamental view of the VOC podcast that communism poses as a quasi-religion based on beliefs rather than facts. The underlying belief common to all communists and most Marxists is a denial of God. The elimination of God-centered morality has produced the horrors committed by communist and Marxist regimes. Like the monotheist faiths since the Book of Exodus in the Bible, there have been a rejection and destruction of heretical images. Use of the practice today by American Marxists highlights the quasi-religious nature of the ideology that seeks through belief to replace Judeo-Christian culture that underpins the current period of prosperity and advancement for all mankind. The culture is threatened by the wave of woke ideology sweeping the United States, the combination of Marxism and radical social egalitarianism. The radical egalitarians may not be ideologically motivated Marxists, but they exquisitely support the goals of the communists, overturning the existing political society to make way for a radical new system. Unlike the constitutional or social democrat leftists, the new American Marxist radicals reject the integrity and legitimacy of the current capitalist democratic order. These radicals take part in the current system solely for the purpose of identifying weaknesses and exploiting fault lines that they plan to use in furthering the destruction of the capitalist system. Like the new left radicals of the 1960s, who closely studied the U.S. democratic system in pursuing Marxist revolution, the BLM radicals are following suit. Jones and Martin write that the ideological origins and the rationale for attacks on U.S. history and culture by BLM and its leftist supporters reflect many of the ideas first formed in Mao's China and known as global Maoism. In earlier podcasts, I noted the similarities between anti-American riots of 2020 and the great proletarian cultural revolution in China in the 60s and 70s. But there are more direct and indirect intellectual and cultural ties between Mao's revolutionary concepts and current radical movements. Today's radical social justice movements have ideological ties to the ideas behind the Cultural Revolution. That's when Mao unleashed communist Red Guard zealots to find and destroy rightists inside the Chinese Communist Party and Chinese society as a whole. A similar Marxist zealotry is fueling the radical social justice movement behind the tearing down of statues of America's founding fathers, the forcing of state-funded universities to decolonize their studies, and environmental radicals seeking a new Green New Deal that is severely weakening the nation through anti-fossil fuel policies and insufficient alternative energies, allegedly to save the planet. Maoism was one of the Communist China's earliest exports to the West. The CCP under Xi Jinping has called the export of its ideology a magic weapon in a covert war to win support and diminish enemies abroad. Chinese revolutionary ideology helped shape the view of Marxist radicals behind BLM and its supporters that since 2020 has been spectacularly successful. Mao's call for cultural revolution was a key influence on the 60s radicals who preceded the current crop of BLM social justice, environmental, and gender identity revolutionaries. And the Chinese Cultural Revolution sought to spiritually transform the masses and recast their social world. Streets and buildings were given new revolutionary names. After destroying culture, mobs turned to destroying people. Arrests and public humiliations targeted the black class of enemies as part of what was termed purist egalitarianism, far beyond the Marxist concept of abolishing private property. The revolution sought to transform the self in pursuit of revolutionary consciousness. The madness lasted until Mao died in 1976. Jones and Martin reveal that as a result of a curious historical conjunction, chance acted upon by choice, and Mao's version of socialism with Chinese characteristics and its commitment to cultural revolution, just happened to coincide with a mixture of affluence, narcissism, boredom, and fascination with the East that inspired the new left radical movement in the late 60s. Anti-Vietnam War sentiment at the time was exploited by the Marxist radicals, who saw Mao's Cultural Revolution as a model for the student protest movements that swept university campuses in 1968. Mao's Little Red Book and posters of Ernesto Che Guevara became trendy radical fashion statements. Maoism provided the radicals with a simpler lexicon, like thought reform, that was easier to promote than the dialectics of European Marxists. Tenets of Maoism on guerrilla warfare influenced radicals and terrorists like Italy's Red Brigades and Germany's Bader-Meinhof gang. And we can also see Mao's tactics in the Islamic State terrorists, who also rely on those guerrilla warfare tactics. Also, there was the California-based Black Panther Party. It was the Black Panthers who first called for killing police. Off the pigs, they said. And that's resurfaced in a much more concrete way in 2020 under the BLM campaign to defund the police. As police forces were denigrated and their funding reduced, crime skyrocketed in major cities, further advancing the Marxist goal of destabilizing the main capitalist system. Earlier radicals failed to inspire Marxist revolution after governments in the West uniformly recognized them as a criminal threat. Many of the radicals ended up in jail or dead. But their ideology did not die. Maoist intellectuals in several European capitals and on American university campuses quietly fueled a new generation of radicals who would adopt elements of Maoism in seeking to weaken capitalist power structures. Jones and Smith reveal that Maoism joined forces ideologically with the Frankfurt School of Marxism in providing a deconstructive assault on the West. Terrorist groups in Africa, Southeast Asia, and South America included many revolutionaries who had traveled to China in the 50s and 60s. As I've mentioned frequently in earlier podcasts, Maoism was a central feature of the New Left's so-called long march through the institutions of America that Jones and Smith say was coined by radical student leader Rudy Dutschke. Mao's Long March in 1935 was a military retreat by the Communist Party's forces from nationalist forces during the struggle for power and is considered a stepping stone for Mao coming to power. The radicals' Long March is now being felt as Marxists now populate key positions in government and the private sector. Their influence helped produce critical race theory, cancel culture, iconoclasm, and the radicalization of universities and their curricula. A key feature of Maoism is its fluidity. Mao favored a variety of means and tactics to achieve his goal of seizing power. He backed terrorism in population control, but warned of its excesses. He advocated guerrilla warfare, but also valued traditional military power. Mao's methods produced what the Chinese military now calls unrestricted warfare, the use of all means and methods to win conflicts against enemies. Mao's version of communism emphasized not the working class as history's heroes. For Mao, it was the poor and the rural Chinese peasant who became the ideological core of communist revolution and national renewal. Under Xi Jinping, this concept is now the rallying cry behind all-out ideological warfare against the West that Xi has called national rejuvenation, a plan to make China the unchallenged global superpower and replace the United States. Maoist ideology remains integral to the CCP today, even though Mao, the leader, and his murderous personality cult are only partially recognized. The CCP regards Mao as 70% correct and 30% flawed. Global Maoism remains central to CCP foreign policy, albeit in very low-key terms. Maoism in this form has been described as political behaviors that range from anarchic democracy to Machiavellian brutality against political enemies. Overseas, Maoism has been defined as a mix of party-building discipline, anti-colonial rebellion, and continuous revolution, grafted onto the secular religion of Soviet Marxism. The new radical Marxists left in America are using Maoism as reflected in radical social justice and equality, in challenging the existing political order and ultimately seeking to overthrow or radically recast that order. Under the new Maoism, political arguments are never-ending and extremely loud and angry. They have produced contemporary politics that are in a state of near political civil war. The current rage of American Marxists behind the woke movement is skillfully using indignation and resentment that are supporting anti-capitalist revolution. And it is Maoist ideology that is facilitating the passions of the radical left. Jones and Smith warned that the post-World War II prosperity and advanced social equality is producing greater disharmony and division because of the use of Maoist ideology by American Marxists in pursuit of power. Sowing discord undermines the key features of democracy, consensus building, grievance management, and internal accommodation. And this has a direct link to the Maoism worldview. Jones and Smith conclude that Western democratic societies face a serious threat from Maoist ideological subversion. Western democracy is built on principles that support open and genuinely pluralistic societies. These principles are being challenged by American Marxists and their Maoist ideology bent on radical transformation of the capitalist system they regard as a central evil. The non-ideological West is facing a Chinese Communist East capable of reaching deep inside American society through Maoist revolutionary ideology and represents a real and present danger. This is the reason the best solution to this challenge is a faith-based victory over communism worldview that I have been presenting. It provides a unique solution for defending and maintaining free societies and open societies against the ideological assault from China. As Jones and Smith put it, without a willingness to defend the traditional tenets of liberal democracy, the likelihood of further social breakdown and appeal to new forms of authority are likely. This was the fate of those who suffered the misfortune of enduring Maoist-inspired Cultural Revolution. I'll be right back.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File, that's gertzfile.com, or at the book site called deceivingthesky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. This is the counterproposal section, what I call the spiritual section. In this section, I address what I call the victory over communism worldview that is drawn from the divine principle, a teaching of the late Reverend Sun Myung-moon, who presents a comprehensive view of God, humankind, and the universe. This episode addresses knowing God and presents a common sense view of religious epistemology, a theory of knowledge based on justified beliefs, not opinions. Understanding God is critical to countering communist and Marxist ideology that is rigidly anti-God. The problem of knowing God is complicated because the very nature of God means he is invisible and not material. That is why no one has yet confined God to a test tube. A God that we could touch and see and photograph would not be the God we are seeking. Then how can we understand God? Although we will not try to define God, the Judeo-Christian tradition provides us with a description. God must be good, infinite, omnipotent, and omnipresent, eternal, unchanging, and unique. He is, as Saint Anselm observed in the 11th century, the being than which no greater can be conceived. Thus, God must be bigger than yourself, bigger than the world, bigger even than the whole cosmos. God certainly cannot be fully grasped by any single individual's perception. Such a God would not be God. Our inability to directly perceive God seems to prevent a dilemma. A child knows and recognizes his father. Children do not have to make any effort to believe in their parents. They know them as a matter of fact. In the same way, we would expect that there must be some way that the children of God can recognize him as their creator and father. This avenue of knowing and recognizing God must be open to all of his children, not just to those who may be trained in theology or science. God would not make humankind without giving him the capability of knowing his creator. There must be a way to recognize God. The VOC worldview proposes a common-sense approach to knowing God, as opposed to complex theological or philosophical methods. I believe that it must be possible for everyone to become convinced of God's existence. To achieve this, I'm going to outline a common-sense approach to learning about God. There are basically three ways to recognize the existence of God. There's science, philosophy, and by experience. How do we learn things? One way is through science. Science begins with empirical observation. That is, science begins by seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching things. Then, through the application of logic and reasoning, science expands the powers of human perception. This is done by means of scientific experiments. For example, air is invisible. We can't see it directly. We can, however, blow on a piece of paper, and we can interpret what we're seeing. We then understand that air is moving against the paper. A second general way we can extend our knowledge is closely related to science, and that's through philosophy. Philosophy also uses observations, logic, and reasoning. Philosophy calls upon us to carefully examine our ideas and the ways of thinking to make them better. Philosophy demands that we consider various problems. Through philosophic means, for example, we can explore the question of the existence of our minds, which are totally invisible and untouchable. We conclude that every human being has a mind. Third, beyond science and philosophy, we can know things through personal experience. We experience our mother's love, for example. This experience goes beyond science and philosophy. Once we have had such an experience, no power under the sun could bring us to doubt that the love of our mother is real. In perceiving God, then, and in affirming the existence of God, we can use the same methods: science, philosophy, and personal experience. Personal experiences with God are called personal religious experiences. People either believe in or know the existence of God by one or all of these three methods. Regarding science and the existence of God, I want to make clear that it is not the role of science to prove God's existence. Since God is not a material being, his existence is really beyond scientific proof. However, while science has not proven God's existence, the advance of science has taught us a great deal about the universe in which we live. Some of the insights of science have amazing philosophical and religious implications. For this reason, we can say that science has brought human understanding to the threshold of God. Science leads us to the conclusion that the universe can only be completely described by a view which encompasses a first cause. Dr. Paul Davies, for example, in his book God and New Physics, notes that, right or wrong, the fact that science has actually advanced to the point where formerly what we were once religious questions can now be seriously tackled itself indicates the far-reaching consequence of new physics. Davis continues, "In my opinion, science offers a surer path to God than religion." Communists have great faith in science. There was a time, mainly in the 18th and 19th centuries, when the proponents of materialist worldviews, like communism and its precursors, anticipated that science would develop to the point where it would destroy every notion of God. Marx and Engels clearly felt that science was their ally. They called religion the opiate of the masses. This attitude has prevailed into the current century in communist China. The Chinese Communist Party is officially atheist, and religious believers are forbidden to join it. The Chinese Constitution appears to contain provisions on religious freedom, but these provisions are subject to legal challenge under the Chinese state. The constitutional language on religion is a control mechanism that permits only a Communist Party-defined normal religious activity, narrowly defined as practices undertaken at times and places approved by the state that support the government and the party and its policies. This includes state-defined dogma that religions are purely human creations and that God and other supernatural beings do not exist. Chinese communism asserts that all religions have a trajectory that will produce their eventual decline and disappearance. As a propaganda power, the CCP believes it can change people's beliefs through what it euphemistically calls patriotic education. Those who believe in God must be eliminated or re-educated under communism. Prior to China's repression of religion, the Soviet Union was the main anti-God power. In the early days of the Soviet space program, Moscow's propagandists even joked that the exploration of space by cosmonauts would prove that there was no God in heaven, and that notions of God and Christ would soon be relegated to mythology. Quite the contrary to this expectation, a survey of remarkable advances of 20th century science and technology shows that quite the opposite is taking place. The present trend of science suggests that it is communism rather than Christianity which will be relegated to mythology. So, what is the relationship between science and the nature of life? The origin of life has always been an intriguing question for biologists. The theory of biogenesis, that life comes only from life, was put forth in 1858 by Rudolf Virchow in Germany. A few years later, the work of Louis Pasteur in France offered convincing proof of the biogenesis theory. Recently, however, great efforts have been made to show that spontaneous generation of life is possible. Until now, these efforts have not been successful. It has been shown that when a mixture of ammonia, methane, water, and hydrogen is subjected to electrical discharges, amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, are formed. However, no protein chains can be formed without additional efforts to synthesize them. Until now, the principle remains that life comes only from life. Only a living being can create and generate other living beings. What would be the cause of all living things? The logical conclusion would be that the cause of all living beings must be another living being. That first cause must be alive. In other words, God, the Creator, must be a living being. What about matter and energy? We can also approach the question of God's existence by considering the nature of matter and energy as viewed by physics and chemistry. As time has gone by, scientists have drastically refined their notions of matter and energy. The nature of energy and its relation to matter has been obscure through most of history. Greek philosophers had certain insights regarding matter and energy, but their efforts are crude by today's standards. Democritus held that matter consists of atoms, which are solid, rigid, indivisible, internally homogeneous, and spatially extended. At the same time, heat, a form of energy, was thought to be fluid permeating from a substance. The development of quantum mechanics helped define more clearly the concepts of force and energy, although many argue that it only added to the inability of defining reality. Quantum mechanics is viewed by many as science's most precise, powerful theory of reality, but scientists and philosophers are unable to agree on what the idea of waveforms means. New scientific discussions point to information rather than matter and energy as an element of quantum mechanics. The theory has been applied to black holes in space, but the concept of information existing apart from conscious beings to send, receive, and act upon the information doesn't answer the major questions about the origin of the universe. One element of quantum mechanics supports the existence of a first cause. It is the observer effect. Under what scientists call the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, it says that quantum wave function, such as the position of a particle in a medium at any time, will collapse when an observation is made by an observer. That supports the existence of God because it means there must be an observer in place from the beginning of time at the creation of the universe. Science also has been unable to assess consciousness. Explaining consciousness as neural processes like electrochemical impulses in the brain has failed. There are scientific theories now asserting that quantum effects underpin consciousness. The reality is that we are born and live with consciousness, pursuing goodness and higher value. This did not originate from human beings, but from the origin of mankind, God. Science has also shown that various types of energy, such as mechanical, radiant, and chemical, were inconvertible. A major revolution in our understanding of energy came with the development of nuclear physics. Just prior to the outbreak of World War I, the English physicist Ernest Rutherford discovered that the atom consists of a tiny core called the nucleus, surrounded by a tenuous cloud of electrons. In 1934, Italian Enrico Fermi split the uranium nucleus into several fragments, releasing a sizable amount of nuclear energy, but he did not realize what had happened. Within a few years, however, scientists began to understand more about the process. In 1940, the first controlled chain reaction was carried out in a secret laboratory under the abandoned football stands of the University of Chicago's Stagg Field. In splitting atomic nuclei, we find that a certain amount of matter becomes completely converted into energy. We could say then that one of the most recent advances in understanding matter and energy is the realization that they are the same thing. All this helps to understand that Marxist materialism will be consigned to the dustbin of history. Marxism was once based upon a certain perspective of matter being solid, being real, being tangible, and being reducible to indivisible particles. In the 20th century, particularly because of the discovery of nuclear energy, it becomes clear that this view of matter is primitive. In fact, the conversion of matter to energy was predicted by Einstein's theory of relativity. According to this theory, energy and matter are interconvertible and interchangeable. At this point, the communist belief that the universe is matter having motion as its attribute is clearly seen to be antiquated and must be thrown into the dustbin of history. Energy and matter considered together appear to be conserved, that is, they can be neither created nor destroyed. The question then becomes, how does energy become matter? How does it develop into a higher and higher level of sophistication? Certainly, it is not by accident or random selection. The universe exhibits precise discipline and orderliness. How did it come about? Materialism offers no explanation. From the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim points of view, God is the cause of both energy and lawfulness, and the creation has come about as God has expressed his character into material form through the medium of energy. This is how a disciplined, orderly universe came into being. The basic assumption of science itself is that nothing occurs without cause. Thus, science supports the existence of an orderly first cause. The third law of thermodynamics states that unless energy is added to a closed system, it will tend to move in a state of greater disorder or greater entropy. What we find, even according to evolution, is that there has been an upward development of man. Things are advancing to a more sophisticated level. At this point, we must recognize a creative will behind the developmental process. The reality of a first cause is becoming more and more apparent. Einstein's studies in science led him to one conclusion: there must be a God. Einstein himself concluded, "I want to know how God created this world. I want to know his thoughts, and the rest are just details." Regarding Einstein's views, scientist and author Robert Jastrow writes, "For Einstein, the existence of God was proven by the laws of nature, that is, the fact that there was an order in the universe and man could discover it." When Einstein came to New York in 1921, a rabbi sent him a telegram asking, "Do you believe in God?" And Einstein replied, "I believe in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists." To the total disappointment of the followers of Marx and Engels, science has turned out to be God's disciple instead of an ally of communism. So far, science has done a remarkable job of helping us affirm the existence of God, bringing us to the threshold of knowing the existence of God. We cannot ask anything further of science. At this point, we turn to philosophy to tell us more about God's existence. I'll talk about that in the next podcast. I'll be right back.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Welcome back. This is the news section of the podcast. In January, the far-left political magazine The Nation published a lengthy article revealing strong political affinity for Chinese communism among the Democratic Socialists of America, the United States' largest socialist party, whose members include Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and a growing number of other elected officials. The article was titled, "What Should the Left Do About China?" And it stated that leftists were attempting to develop a U.S. foreign policy toward China that opposes military confrontation, at the same time recognizing oppressive policies by Beijing. The Nation advocates for left-wing political change, but does not overtly identify itself as Marxist. Its webpage suggests its support for revolution. We raise up the promise of a radical tomorrow while we agitate for meaningful change today. American leftists, strongly opposed to the American system of government and economics, are struggling with how to respond to a Chinese communist system that is engaged in genocide against minority Uyghurs in Western China and have all but destroyed the democratic system in Hong Kong. DSA, or Democratic Socialists of America, bills itself as the largest socialist organization in the United States, claiming 92,000 members. Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders is not a member, but calls himself a Democratic Socialist and supports the group with a link to the DSA website on his webpage. DSA regards Sanders as a key ally for its ideological drive to impose socialism on the country. Sanders, it should be noted, spent his honeymoon in the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War, an indication that his brand of socialism could well be the kind viewed by Marxist-Leninists as a temporary stage on the road to ideal communism. The DSA website states that capitalism is a system designed by the owning class to exploit the rest of us for their own profit. We must replace it with a democratic socialism, a system where ordinary people have a real voice in our workplaces, neighborhoods, and society, the website said. Its goals are actually to gain power through elective office and, once in power, to collectively own the key economic drivers that dominate our lives, such as the energy production and transportation, end quote. DSA also wants a multiracial working class united in solidarity. It puts radical in quotation marks around its main priority of promoting what it calls single-payer Medicare for all. It also supports the BLM movement to defund the police, and it backs the radical Green New Deal that would cripple the current U.S. system of energy if imposed. The website also doesn't tell you that DSA wants to eliminate the Senate. It considers it unrepresentative. Quote, "The capitalist class tells us we are powerless, but together we can take back control," DSA says. In reality, the DSA is an American Marxist organization that is seeking to radically transform the American system of democracy and free markets. As the threat from China is increasing on many fronts, American leftists are trying to figure out how to deal with the threat that includes growing tensions over Taiwan, Chinese military bases on islands in the South China Sea as part of an effort to take control of one of the world's most strategic waterways, and ramped up tensions with U.S. ally Japan in the East China Sea, where China is claiming Japan's uninhabited Senkaku Islands as its territory. The islands are said to have large undersea oil and gas deposits, so far undeveloped. The Nation spoke to a DSA member named Promise Lee, a Hong Kong-born resident who started a leftist group of activists in Hong Kong called the Laosun Collective that has been pushing back against Chinese human rights abuses. After China's crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong several years ago, when police brutally beat and imprisoned thousands of protesters, Lee proposed that DSA issue a statement condemning the shutdown of Hong Kong's largest independent labor union. I'd note here that closing non-communist labor unions has been a first step for many communist regimes. For China's communist rulers, the Solidarity Trade Movement in Poland during the late 1980s made any union not under strict Communist Party control a major threat. Solidarity was the key to bringing down communism in Eastern Europe. Based on Lee's request, DSA's Asia and Oceania subcommittee conducted a straw poll. It is not clear if the issue was raised at the DSA's 18-member Politburo-like National Political Committee, the group that directs operations and sets policies. Ann Lin Wong, an American-born Chinese DSA member and co-chair of the Asia and Oceania Subcommittee, told The Nation there was an overwhelming 3-to-1 consensus against saying anything to condemn the Chinese communists. "We tried our hardest to make sure that this was as maximally democratic as possible," Wang said. "I think there are strong arguments on both sides." But Lee blamed the failure to condemn the closure of the independent Hong Kong trade union on the influence within DSA of tankies, that is, defenders of communist regimes. "There's a big group of people who aren't exactly tankies, but see the tanky side as equally valid and try to preserve the unity of the left," Lee said. The DSA struggle is said to be a microcosm of a bigger debate among American Marxists and socialists over whether to ignore China's human rights violations and mounting concerns about a future war between the United States and China in support of advancing socialism. President Biden and his administration are basically pursuing the new and harder line policy toward China put in place during the Trump administration. The main difference is that the terminology and rhetoric used by the Biden team are different, a bit more vague and conciliatory towards China. According to The Nation, many on the left who work on China are trying to navigate between avoiding a new Cold War — the Chinese are already waging one, by the way — while seeking increased cooperation with China on liberal causes. Leftists are unwilling to denounce oppressive Beijing policies, from the crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong to the genocide of Uyghurs in Xinjiang, and oppose a neoliberal trade order that benefited American and Chinese corporate elites at the expense of the U.S. and Chinese workers, according to them. The left fears an escalation of tensions will be a disaster, perhaps leading to a military conflict and the lost opportunity to work with China on climate change. The Biden administration, too, is divided on the issue. There's moderates in the White House led by China policy expert Kurt Campbell, who's battling to keep the new Trump policy in place. Campbell and the senior officials who are moderates at State and Pentagon and the Pentagon are being fiercely opposed by a group of leftists and radicals led by John Kerry, the former Secretary of State who is now the climate czar. Kerry has stated publicly that the U.S. government's differences with China will not be allowed to interfere with his effort to seek Beijing's cooperation on curbing climate change. Too late. China announced in early August, after the visit to Taiwan by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, that it's suspending climate talks with the United States, a blow to the Kerry faction, but a boon to the moderates. The Nation article is useful in identifying leftist and Marxist groups involved in China affairs. For example, there's Keisha Brown, who teaches modern Chinese history and Afro-Asian disparatic identities at Tennessee State University. Brown is a co-founder of the Black China Caucus, an organization of China specialists from the African diaspora. Brown worries that people-to-people diplomacy and travel to China by black students will be lost from U.S.-China tensions. American leftists fear a new Cold War and are promoting non-militaristic and humanitarian foreign policies to support those positions. Some leftists have latched onto the Biden policy of competing with China by promoting democracy and free markets. But Bernie Sanders' aide Matt Duss is opposing the confrontational approach to China, telling the magazine, "We don't need China as a justification to strengthen our democracy, rebuild our industry, and create a better life for Americans. We should do these things because they're the right thing to do." Leftists appear really ignorant of China's brand of communism. The Nation says those on the left that were interviewed question whether Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics is actually China's guiding ideology. It most certainly is. They also wonder whether China is a normal nation that's part of the global neoliberal order. Liberals and leftists also are confused about whether China is communist or capitalist, a credit to Beijing's decades of strategic deception that gave it access to Western money and markets. Some Marxists see the communist system as the alternative to the American economic hegemony, and others wonder if China is undergirding that U.S. hegemony. The most worrisome group engaged with American Marxists on the left on China is an organization called Qiao Collective, QIAO, that emerged as a countergroup to Li's Laosun Collective. A review of its Twitter feed indicates the group displays all the hallmarks of a Chinese Communist Party United Front Work Department front group. According to The Nation, Qiao was launched in early 2020, around the same time as Li's group. It would not identify its members and says it reaches decisions collectively. In a statement to The Nation, Qiao said it is a group of students, artists, researchers, and young professionals in the U.S., U.K., and Canada who contribute as volunteers in our spare time. Our members all belong to the broader Chinese diaspora with family connections to mainland China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and throughout Southeast Asia. The group claims it has no formal ties to any political party, including the Chinese Communist Party, but would not disclose the size of its membership, how it is governed, and who specifically is responsible for organizing it. The tell about the group is that its narrative spread in American leftist circles closely aligns with the Chinese Communist Party propaganda. In July, on its website, Qiao praised the CCP, quote, "The centenary of the founding of the Communist Party of China marks a historical juncture for the Chinese nation and its pursuit of a modern socialist society," end quote. Qiao criticized the Hong Kong protests as anti-communist and driven by a, quote, "fetishization of abstract liberalism, British colonial nostalgia, anti-Chinese racism, and appeals to Western intervention." The group accused Li of left-washing, what it called right-wing protests in Hong Kong. Qiao has rapidly become popular on social media and has contributed an article warning against a U.S.-China war to the Progressive International, a left-wing global wire service. The group has influenced the anti-war group Code Pink that cites Qiao on its China fact page. Monthly Review, an independent socialist magazine published in New York, also republished Qiao Collective material. Qiao has dismissed reports of torture, mass imprisonment, and other crimes against Uyghurs in China as Western atrocity propaganda. Another group critical of Chinese human rights abuses and other nefarious activities is called Critical China Scholars, a group of young academics that has been pushing back against Qiao's positions. It also tried to convince the Democratic Socialists of America to counter Qiao's pro-China narratives, but also was rebuffed by the socialist organization. Some in DSA support Communist China based on anti-U.S. and foreign policy positions. Li, the Hong Kong-born DSA member, said Qiao is authoritarian, fascist, and has nothing to do with socialism. Quote, "The quality of their content and the caliber of their information is no better than InfoWars. But there's been an influx of their fans into DSA, especially in San Francisco's Red Star Caucus." Well, DSA has a Marxist Red Star Caucus in San Francisco that declares on its website that Red Star believes that the formation of a workers' party should be the primary focus of DSA. Here again, you see how socialism, democratic or otherwise, is being co-opted by hardcore Marxist and communist revolutionaries. Here's what Red Star said on its website. "We describe Red Star as a revolutionary Marxist center within DSA. We use the tools of dialectical and historical materialism to guide our courses of action as scientific socialists, and we act according to a system of democratic accountability for collective and delegated decision-making." DSA Asia Director Wang, the one who explained why they didn't condemn China's closing of the union, said the statement condemning China was rejected over concerns that, quote, "signing on to the statement carries a serious risk that it could be used as left-wing support for the broader anti-China effort." I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I spoke to you earlier about my book, Deceiving the Sky. I also wanted to urge you to take a look at another book that I wrote called iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. We live in an information age, and yet we're getting bombarded with enemy propaganda coming at us from all different directions. iWar really helps expose what we need to do and how we need to counter it. I urge you to get a copy. Go to iwarbook.com. That's iwarbook.com. Welcome back. I'm joined now by David Martin Jones and M.L.R. Smith, authors of the new book, The Strategy of Maoism in the West, Rage and the Radical Left. David is a visiting professor at the Department of War Studies at King's College in London and honorary professor of the Humanities Research Institute at the University of Buckingham in the UK. M.L.R. Smith is a professor of strategic theory in the Department of War Studies at King's College. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, good to be with you.
In the book, you identify how the radical left today is connected ideologically to Maoism. Can you expand on that a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. I think one of the interesting things about the way Maoism influenced the left, the new left, particularly in the 60s, was the kind of contingent way it attracted Western youth in the late 60s. If we throw our minds back to that decade, both the superpowers, from an idealistic youth perspective, seemed compromised. The Warsaw Bloc countries seemed locked in a dubious form of Stalinism, and America was seen to be supportive of dubious South American regimes, and of course its role in Vietnam. So idealistic youth, think the Beatles going to India, found China somehow seductive and attractive. So the Cultural Revolution, which they knew little about, took on a patina, a glow of Oriental seductiveness, and was the source of enthusiasm that communicated itself through Mao's mass production of his little red book, which meant that you didn't have to read much theory. You just had to quote one of his aphorisms, like a revolution is not a dinner party, and you were kind of a Maoist. And of course, it was particularly influential amongst the French literati of the period. If you think the recently deceased Jean-Luc Godard made a famous film, Les Chinois, in 1967. Louis, the French equivalent of Playboy, had a centerfold with Red Guard women jumping out of Christmas cakes with AK-47s with the caption saying, "A revolution is not a dinner party." So the attraction of Maoism was contingent in the Cold War experience, but its particular influence was in French intellectual circles, whereas in Germany or Italy, the Maoists took on, you know, guerrilla warfare like the Red Army faction or the Brigata Rossa. In France, the gauche proletarian that came out of the Sorbonne schools, although they talked violence, actually embraced the idea as culture, as a revolutionary dimension, not economics. And that's the basis of the transformative impact of Maoism on Western left thought from the 60s going forward.
Yeah, one of the things that I have frequently mentioned on the podcast, which again focuses on Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics and American Marxism, is the use of the term long march through the institutions. Yeah. I remember back in 68 when the new left radicals were in the street and they got their heads cracked by the Chicago police. And then they launched this new strategy of going inside the system. And it's my belief that they've basically they're there now. They've done that, at least in the United States and probably also in the UK. Can you elaborate on this idea of the long march through the institutions?
Well, yes. Yeah, so I think you'll find plenty of examples in the book which speak to the very theme that you mentioned. And we should bear in mind, of course, that the notion of the long march through the institutions, although it was coined by Rudi Deutschke, the radical German student activist, nevertheless, the linguistic origins, of course, go back to Mao itself, you know, through his long march. And that is what people like Rudi Deutschke and his various acolytes were explicitly referencing. So if you think about the radical student movement in the United States, as you mention, in the late 1960s, eventually transmuting into violent activism of the Weather Underground. The Weather Underground was explicitly influenced by Mao's thinking and its key tract, the Prairie Fire, which you may have come across, is again a direct reference to Mao's idea, you know, that if you start a prairie fire, you will start a revolutionary movement just through starting a prairie fire. And so you can, if you look back at all of the radical tracts in the 1960s, particularly in the United States, through movements like the SDS and the Weather Underground, you will see that all coming to fruition in terms of their ideological movement. Once they retreat from violent activism and they move back into, first of all, the university sector, where they arguably practice, you know, very acute double standards. They take advantage of the liberal freedoms to ensconce themselves in these institutions of free thought, and then develop their ideas outwards, as it were, within the university sectors, first of all, which of course are the first bastions to fall to a Maoist sort of construct. And then, of course, once they produce graduates and they influence their student bodies, they then produce acolytes who then, not through some insidious sort of conspiracy, with this sort of hidden hand, coordinating everything, but through a process of intellectual and practical osmosis, they just diffuse themselves amongst all the rest of the institutions. And of course, we have seen this in many, many facets of contemporary life, certainly in the higher education sector, in terms of cancel culture and rage mobs shouting down speakers, and the way it works its way through to the public and the corporate sectors as well, who are also very much Maoist inflected with ideas of, you know, so-called equality, diversity and inclusion, which overlay a kind of purificatory bureaucracy that aims at rectifying incorrect thought inside these various bodies. And that is Maoism in action.
Yeah. You also mention in the book the term global Maoism. Now, we've seen under Xi Jinping in China, he's kind of revitalized communist ideology a lot. Tell us a little bit about this idea of global Maoism. Is this the Chinese exporting Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics?
It was the first great Chinese export, Bill, I think. I mean, ever since the 30s in the Yunnan cave, Mao saw how potentially enabling Western liberalism could be. If you think the first journalist who interviewed Mao for the American press, Edgar Snow, in Red Star Over China, is taken in by the whole hippie commune aspect of Maoism in Yunnan in the late 1930s. And he describes Mao in that, you know, book, that hagiography, as a lean, gaunt, Lincoln-esque figure. So global Maoism is about this ability to pursue, you know, Maoist thinking through what it called the United Front for Cultural Work. So from the 30s and then through the 60s, it was always interested in bringing over sympathetic academics. If you look at the French experience, Sartre goes to China courtesy of Mao invitation. The group associated with Louis Althusser, the French structuralist Marxist, they have a summer holiday courtesy of the Red Guard. And so too, most famously, is the French literary magazine Tel Quel of Philippe Soler and Julia Kristeva, who then write a spectacularly hagiographic edition of Tel Quel called En Chine. All those influences, that Maoist influence, then affects the whole mode of deconstructive thinking associated with Tel Quel, the Tel Quel group, like Derrida, Foucault, Lacan, all of whose deconstructive agenda is deeply influenced by the idea of Mao's assault on what he calls the compromising nature of liberalism. Liberalism, in other words, becomes the tool through which you penetrate Western academia and Western thought and enable the capacity to undermine Western values. It takes tolerance and uses it against the liberal mind.
Any final comments to sum up on the book?
We hope the book fills a gap in the literature about how we have arrived at our current condition in the West, where we feel that the things that we might have traditionally taken for granted in a liberal society, such as free speech in particular, the right to associate with whom we wish, the right to speak our minds, this has all been very much under threat from a contemporary condition which seems to want to repress those traditional aspects of liberalism. And our contribution, we hope, is to actually trace the origins of much of this thinking to a little explored ideas of Mao Zedong, who you can see as the principal anti-liberal theorist. And I think what a great many contemporary Western liberals fail to appreciate, which I hope the book spells out, is that Maoism is essentially against liberalism. It does not facilitate a liberal understanding of politics. It is explicitly antithetical to a liberal democratic understanding.
Great. We've been talking with David Martin Jones and M.L.R. Smith, authors of the new book, The Strategy of Maoism in the West, Rage and the Radical Left. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. That's it for this episode of Victory Over Communism. I'm your host, Bill Gertz. Again, look to the website victoryovercommunism.net to see podcasts and other information and to provide feedback. Once again, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.